Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Up first in controversies and non-controversies, there is a new greatest film of all time. At least according to the decennial list from the British Film Institute Sight and Sound magazine, Jean Dielman, 23, Quai de Commerce, 1080 Bruxelles. I think I'm getting that mostly right. I'm not a fancy foreigner. It's a feminist slow cinema masterpiece from Chantal Ackerman, and it leapt from number 36 on the 2012 list all the way up to number one on this year's edition, replacing 2012's King Vertigo, which had in turn replaced Citizen Kane, the film that had topped the list for four decades prior to that. I use the term masterpiece a little advisedly here. I've seen the film once, and that was back in college on a VHS that may have been bootlegged or possibly a semi-pirated DVD. I don't even remember. It was for a class. But I'm not going to argue with the experts assembled to make the choices. Well, experts, that's another term I'm using kind of advisedly here, because the pool of critics was massively expanded, nearly doubled, in fact, from 800 to 1,600 or so. Some well-known names of critics dropped off the list. Stalwarts, friends of the show, or at least maybe not the show, but of us, Glenn Kenny, Paul Schrader, folks who, you know, have been on the list for a long time, didn't submit one this year. Meanwhile, lots of folks who were picked up who, as best as anyone can tell, are just kind of on Letterboxd, the movie blog social media site, or have a podcast, you know. Rumors have kind of circulated that there were two rounds of invites, and one can imagine a scenario in which the initial ballots come back and Sight and Sound looks at the list and they panic because it's just the same and there are no films by a woman or a black director in the top 10. And they're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're going to seem so out of touch. We got to commission another round of invites from a younger and more diverse, and more importantly, a group of voters more concerned with diversity to beef up that list. Indeed, the writer-director Schrader, who actually did submit a list to the director's list but not the critics list, suggested as much on his Firebrand Facebook account. He loves mixing it up over there. He is basically saying the quiet part out loud. Quote, the sudden appearance of Jean Dielman in the number one slot undermines the SNS poll's credibility. It feels off, as if someone has put their thumb on the scale. By expanding the voting community and the point system, this year's SNS poll reflects not a historical continuum, but a politically correct rejiggering. Ackerman's film is a favorite of mine, a great film, a landmark film, but its unexpected number one rating does it no favors. Jean Dielman will, from this time forward, be remembered not only as an important film in cinema history, but also as a landmark of distorted woke reappraisal, end quote. Just throwing bombs. Again, though, this is 100% what the folks running the Sight and Sound poll wanted, just as it is 100% what the Academy Awards wanted when they expanded their voting pool, just as it is 100% what Rotten Tomatoes wanted when they expanded its voting pool, right? But folks are very mad at Schrader for speaking plainly what is supposed to be kind of a secret truth here. And if you want to understand how a movie like, say, Get Out or Portrait of a Lady on Fire or Parasite or Moonlighting, all of which made the top 100, are considered better than the collected works of, let's see, Steven Spielberg, Howard Hawks, John Carpenter, Terrence Malick, Robert Altman, and the Coen brothers, none of whom had a single film in the top 100, well, this is how it happens. There's more to discuss about the list. The top 10 was rounded out by Vertigo, Citizen Kane, Tokyo Story, In the Mood for Love, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Beau Travail, Mulholland Drive, Man with a Movie Camera, and Singing in the Rain. But Alyssa, we have to ask, is Schrader right? And B, if that even really matters, if that is just how we are going to do canon formation from now on.
So first off, this is not the real scandal of the Sight and Sound 100 best list. The real scandal is that this group of critics thinks that Sherlock Jr. is a better movie than The General, which is wrong. It's objectively wrong. And the fact that, you know, people are scandalized about the wrong thing is further proof that the entire film community is degenerate and fallen and should be pushed off into the sea. Look, I can't say if Jean Dielman is the best movie ever made because I have never seen it as a person who likes movies but did not have like sort of a formal cinematic education. I can't claim to have seen everything on this list. And in fact, I would say the fact that everyone is as bothered as they are by this is something that on some level I just cannot relate to, right? Like, lists like this are meant to be reflections of consensuses that change over time that obviously reflect the pool of people invited to contribute to them. And there's something funny about the idea that anyone involved with or invested in the exercise would treat it as if, you know, like the cinema gods have, you know, handed down the tablets. Like, the fact that you're doing it over and over and over again, like, there is no mountain to go up to and, like, retrieve the cinema law and return down to your people and have things set in stone. Like, everyone is too invested in these lists as meaning anything. And Schrader is, of course, correct that, like, not in the sense that he's complaining about, you know, woke capture of the list, or, but just that, like, lists are the product of human beings who are themselves the product of, you know, sight and sound sitting there and assembling the people that they want to contribute to the conversation. Like, they're contingent. It's fine. It's just not that big a deal. But yeah, Sherlock Jr., not nearly as good as the general.
Peter, what do you make of the list and the reappraisal here?
Oh, I think it's the apocalypse.
Oh, good.
Movies are over. It's just, that's it. We're going to have to cancel the podcast. This is worse than COVID. We've just, it's done. I just, the whole art form, I think it's ruined. No, look, do we want to, come on. Like, this is, I'm in some ways, I agree with a lot of what Alyssa said, which is that I do not relate to the freakouts over this list. But let's just think a little bit about what Schrader is saying here. His argument, in some sense, is that the results are not legitimate because of who was included, right? I mean, that's essentially, he's saying that this is, that because of the expansion of the list, because of the inclusion of new critics, the results no longer carry the weight or the meaning that they used to carry. That is, that's a pretty direct implication of what he's saying. And I guess like, on the one hand, you can see the argument for that in that, well, you know, the massive expansion means that there's no continuity, right, with previous lists, and that changes the meaning of the list, right? If you suddenly have a whole bunch of different people who are right, like, then it's not a consistent measurement over time, because what you've done is you've changed the makeup of the voting pool. And so in some way, you can make an argument that's you know, that sort of doesn't have anything to do even with who the people are. That's just like, well, that makes the list less legitimate than if they'd basically just stuck with the old members and the old ways of adding members slowly, keeping the numbers at, you know, 800 critics or whatever. At the same time, the addition of the Letterboxd critics, of people with podcasts, man, the podcast critics are the absolute
worst. Trash people.
Do we think that is somehow less legitimate? And I guess you could say, well, look, somebody writing for the New York Times, that A.O. Scott's opinions matter more. Like, okay, you can make that argument. I don't think that's totally insane. But who is it who is creating the new canon of films today? Where are younger critics writing with the dwindling of outlets? Where are movie opinions being shared and hashed out? Frankly, the young critics are writing on weird little websites that you might not have heard of, or Letterboxd, or whatever it is. And they're hashing out opinions on Twitter and on podcasts. And so I think there is an argument that these folks are just as legitimate today as the, you know, the old newspaper critics.
Here's the cinema
20
crowd.
Or 30 years
well,
ago, right?
Yeah, and also, let's be honest, like, a lot of film magazines were essentially the equivalent of, like, weird little blogs.
You
know? Right. It's, I mean, every generation of arts writers has its weird little fill in the box here.
It's that cantankerous upstarts who,
yes,
build their own outlets and their own publications, right? Who don't go through established channels, and who are writing either in direct reaction to the older establishment, or just without much regard for it, because it's they live in a totally different world. And I will say I have, like, some sympathy for this idea that the poll was rejiggered to get a specific outcome, and therefore, like, okay, like, that changes the meaning of it. But what counts as, what makes someone legitimate as a film critic? What makes their opinion matter? Is it that they, is it the outlet that they write for, or is it the force and strength of their opinion? Now, you know, again, to go back to and make maybe Paul Schrader's point, what he might say here is, well, do we have an assessment of each critic's legitimacy and, you know, why they're being included here and what makes them, you know, worthy of inclusion? We don't. I don't think there's a list of critics that like gives us a rating for each one. And is like, here's why we included this person rather than, say, somebody else. At the same time, I just like there's no way to do this that isn't where that isn't in some sense arbitrary, that isn't in some sense sort of directed by someone who by someone or someone's who have probably some sort of agenda. Like there's no way for the Sight and Sound poll folks who are running it to not have an like for them to have an objective like, oh, we just want objectively the best films. There's the whole business is subjective. That's what we do. We make subjective judgments about which films are good and which films aren't every single week on this podcast.
And so own it. Write about the, you know, the process of selecting invitations, but like be honest and clear about what you were trying to do and making up the list of nominators. Just like own the contingency, own the non-biblical nature of the process. And then also just everyone on the internet, like chill, accept that explanation, argue about it. Like the arguing should be fun, not some sort of deeply embittered high stakes freak out.
Well, this is one of the things that I find so funny about the whole conversation is that a lot of people are very, very mad at Paul Schrader, even though he is. I think this is obviously just objectively what Sight and Sound was trying to do. They were trying to broaden the pool of voters. They were trying to make it younger, more diverse in order to create a different canon, to update the canon somewhat. And they got what they wanted. And I don't understand why anybody would object to stating that plainly. But I think that Schrader is also right that it creates a disjunction with previous iterations of the poll. Alyssa, you said something that this it's not like there's a mountain to scale or tablets to be handed down. But that's actually not entirely true, right? One of the stories of the Sight and Sound poll is the increase in respect for like Vertigo, right? Which climbed up the poll every year and finally toppled Citizen Kane. There are interesting stories to look at the people who are moving up and down the list and the films that are moving up and down the list and what comes on and what drops off. And when you have this disjunction in the poll, it does create a kind of before and after feeling, which maybe is good and maybe it's bad, but it is again, it's just objectively, I think, true.
But then, you know, this is also a problem that can be solved with some creative presentation, right? Like, you know, let people filter the results by critics lists, for example. Like you could do a version of it where you see like classic mode, or you could, you know, break out a you could literally create a web tool that allows you to pick the pool of critics that you're interested in and generate a ranking based on what they submitted.
See, this is somebody with the Washington Post tech team desk at her disposal offering up suggestions right here. This is all very fancy. It's not just a list.
Right? But also it'd be fun. I mean, I think it would be really interesting to see what the Sight and Sound classic version of the 2022 poll is versus, you know, what the newbies are bringing in. Or, you know, it could be really interesting to sort the critics by gender, generation. Like, I think that look, for something like this.
Yeah, I want the cross tabs on this, right? Like, let's treat this like a political. This is both a good idea, but it also undermines the central purpose of this, which is to establish a canon that can't be split apart and broken. That's what the goal of the Sight and Sound poll is, to say there's one list, there's one objectively best film. And I just think that's a crazy kind of goal, right? Like it's not something
that
is going
to. But that's not the goal. The goal is to create, the goal is to start a jumping off point for argument. And I feel like we're arguing about the wrong thing right now, right? Like everyone is arguing about the methodology of the poll and not the quality of the films.
Man, that feels really familiar in like some way here with like, I don't know, American politics or something. I feel like I like encountered that.
But to continue my sort of Jewish theological metaphor here, which also perfectly sets us up for the next movie that we're going to discuss, like the thing about canons, like Moses descends from the Temple Mount with the Ten Commandments. And in Jewish tradition, you have these texts called midrashes, which are just rabbis arguing over what the Talmud means, right? Like, there is a long tradition of like, okay, yes, we have the canon. Like, yes, we have the rules. Yes, we have the Bible. But come on, things are still not settled. Like, we have to argue them out. And that's how something like this should function. Even if it's canonical, you're going to be setting it up for interpretation and argument. And, you know, presenting it in a way that allows for that kind of commentary and discussion, and then encourages that sort of commentary and discussion as a feature, not a bug, and then readers bringing a willingness to engage would just make for a healthy culture around all of this. So, you know, film critics should be more like Jews. Clearly, that's the message of all of this.
I think we just put Sonny in charge of everything.
Yes, and then finally!
And then all of the complaints go directly to him so that he can respond to them on Twitter.
Number one movie in the Sight and Sound poll in 2032, Zack Snyder's Justice League. Now, well, come on, let's not be ridiculous, Alyssa. That's like number 20 or 30. The other thing that is interesting here, I just want to briefly touch on this because it is an interesting little tidbit. I think of the 100 films on this list, some 50 or so, nearly half the list is distributed by Janus/Criterion, which is the kind of beloved art house indie distributor, which I think says a lot about the process of canon formation in the first place. There's like a gatekeeper above the gatekeepers saying like, you know what's pretty good? It's this Chantal Ackerman fella, lady, person.
The 400 blows.
Watch your movies. And I, again, it's you know, there's always somebody with a finger on the scale somewhere. It just depends on where you want to look. All right, what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that the Sight and Sound list has been perverted by rogue wokesters? Alyssa.
Controversy, also nerds.
Peter.
It's a controversy. It genuinely doesn't matter. Movies are either good or bad, or you like them or you don't. And this list is mostly irrelevant to that, except, you know, in the sense that it's going to inform a little bit of like what today's, you know, sort of budding cineasts are going to, you know, try to educate themselves on.
It's definitionally controversial to the extent that the whole point of the list is to prompt arguments, as we're discussing. The whole point of the list is to you know, create a fight over which movie is actually the best film objectively ever made. But it's also a controversy because if you're telling people who are interested in the art of film that this 3.5-hour movie about a woman that is cooking dinner in her house for large portions of it is the best movie of all time, you're creating a real hurdle for some folks who want to get into films. I think it might be actually bad, just capital B bad, for the art of film loving, but that's possibly a debate for
It's no Mulholland Drive, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, that movie also has challenges, but anyway, at any rate, make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com on Friday for a special bonus episode on the Disney Plus series Andor, which we have all finally caught up on and would like to discuss with each other and you, gentle listeners. Now, on to the main event, The Fabelmans, Steven Spielberg's semi and really mostly autobiographical look at his own childhood. The Fabelmans has been pitched to audiences as a sort of movie about movies, right? It's a movie about the magic of movies. Movies are dreams that you can hold on to forever or whatever. But it's not that exactly. It's not exactly that. It's much more a movie about a kid trying to figure out why his parents can't quite make their relationship work and why he can't really relate to them entirely and why he can only really relate to the world through the lens of film, right? Either by watching life through a camera or by piecing it all together in an editing bay, by figuring out how to make the world of movies look like the world of life, et cetera, et cetera. The best sequences in this picture involve that figuring, that process of discovery, right? Young Sammy Fabelman, the Spielberg stand-in, is asked by his father to cut together footage from the family camping trip in an effort to boost his mother's spirits. The father knows she needs something he can't give her and hopes that his son can help. She's the family artist, a pianist. He's the family technician, a computer guy. And Sammy is kind of the synthesis of the two of them. We watch him cut the film together while Spielberg is cutting between Sammy putting the film together and his father, Bert, who is smiling at Mitzi, who is very sad, playing the piano. And as Sammy is cutting his camping film together, we and he start to see something. Mitzi and family friend Benny in the background. They're holding hands, they're sharing hats, they're stealing looks. They are quite obviously in love. Sammy recoils from the editing bay when he sees this. He's almost physically repelled by it. film has shown him something he cannot see in the real world and something he doesn't want to see in his real life, right? It pulled back a hidden truth. And he kind of resents the knowledge that it has imparted onto him. Again, this is the movie at its best, right? When it's not a movie about movies. It's a movie about somebody who can only understand the world through movies. And I feel like I'm splitting hairs here, but it's a very important distinction. And again, it's very autobiographical. It's honestly a little bit masturbatory. But here's the thing. Steven Spielberg is the signature American visual artist of the last quarter of the so-called American century. He is almost indisputably the greatest critical and commercial force in the most important artistic medium of that age. And as such, I'd rather see him address his life in the medium he has mastered, that is, the feature film, than in a ghostwritten autobiography or some 10-part miniseries on HBO Max, right? The Fablemans probably too long. It's certainly a little self-indulgent. Doesn't entirely hang together. It's a bit soggy, but there is greatness in the individual scenes and sequences, as when Sammy shows the film he made of Senior Ditch Day at prom, or when he meets John Ford, who is played with comic abrasiveness by David Lynch. Judd Hirsch has a memorable turn as the kind of ultra-Jewish uncle whose life and entertainment has led to family heartbreak. Gabriel LaBelle is quite good as Sammy Fableman, though I'm alone in this. I am like almost entirely unmoved by Michelle Williams as his mother and Paul Dano as his father. They're fine, but weirdly mannered and stilted. I didn't like it. I didn't like what they were doing for whatever reason. The movie is okay, is what I'm saying. Peter is okay enough.
I think it's much better than okay, although I'm not quite sure it's great. Somewhat weirdly, this movie felt kind of like an MCU film to me, like a Marvel movie, right? Except, you know, because it's just like filled with sneaky Easter eggs and like references to a whole bunch of other movies and all these like sort of kind of fan theory things, except the universe isn't a big comic book universe. It's Steven Spielberg's life and the formative films of the 1970s and 80s that he grew up with and were sort of part of his coming of age as a director, right? So you mentioned that incredible sequence where Sam is cutting together bits from the camping trip that his family went on and comes to realize that his mother and Benny are in love. And that whole thing, as you pointed out in your review, Sonny, is that whole thing is a clear reference, allusion to Brian De Palma and Blowout, but just to the sort of Brian De Palma way of seeing the world and of cutting together these moments where you come to understand something through the slow sort of repetition and build of audio or video, right? Of like, it's sort of this pure cinema thing. It's so wonderfully shot. It's so effective. It's definitely the best sequence in the film, but the movie has quite a few sequences that are really quite effective along those lines. And there's also just, there's references to all, to, you know, other parts of like Spielberg's work, to E.T. and Indiana Jones in particular, maybe to 1941 and definitely to Saving Private Ryan if you're looking for them. But also, I think you can pick out references to Martin Scorsese, right? Like all the stuff with his Christian girlfriend under the, you know, under the cross, and George Lucas, and just that whole recurring bit that you mentioned about John Ford and the payoff at the very end that's so great. And so it's just kind of fascinating as an act of critical movie brain synthesis, right? And like Spielberg is famous for having like perfect recall of every shot of every movie he's ever seen. And you can see that in this, and that he remembers and once in his shaping and is casting his own life through the lens of the movies he made, but also of the movies that his contemporaries made, right? He can only understand life through movies. And so the movie, of course, just tells us that kind of in direct language sometimes. But it's also showing us that, is that he sees everything through the lens of movies. And then it does this other weird thing. This is a movie about Steven Spielberg, about Sammy, the Spielberg stand-in. But it's kind of weirdly not about Sammy. It's about his parents. And he sees himself almost entirely through the lens of his parents' psychology, his parents' psychologies, and the interplay between them. And so it would be like if I asked you, Sonny, hey, Sonny, tell me a little about yourself. And you didn't say one word about yourself. Instead, you started with, well, my dad was a, and then my mom was a, and I was supposed to then infer from that what you're like. And it's just this sort of fascinating thing where it's like we almost don't get any direct insight into the Spielberg stand-in. We get instead the story of his parents and who they were and their conflicts and how their conflicts were the thing that he had to deal with as a kid and the thing that in some ways defined him and his family. And there's a way in which Spielberg is saying, my movies are in some sense, like there's nothing to me. And my movies are just a product of the interplay between my parents and their, you know, my father's very technical approach to the world, somewhat emotionless, and my mother's very sort of emotional and artistic approach to the world. And my mother's, you know, right, he sees his mother as somebody who is sort of stifled creatively, you know, and followed. And part of the argument, I think, implicit in this is that she followed her passion and left dad for Betty because of the artistic stifling that she felt, right? Like that was the time when she had to follow her passion. Interestingly, if I understand correctly, Spielberg in real life did not find out that his mom was the instigator until much, much later. And so his first couple of movies were actually about bad dads, right? And sort of had these bad dad relationships. And it was only later in life that he discovered that the breakup was driven by his mom, because he, as a young man, if I understand correctly, blamed his father for the breakup. But it's just, it's a fascinating, you know, sort of approach to not quite autobiography, because obviously not all the details are real, but to sort of thinking about the self and self-definition and why you are the way you are. And other people will sort of, when you ask them about themselves, they tell you about them. And his story is, well, let me tell you about my parents. Let me tell you about my lineage and where I came from.
It's interesting, in the pre-roll before this movie at the Alamo Drafthouse, I saw it at the Alamo Drafthouse with a paying audience, in the pre-roll they show a clip from Spielberg's appearance on Inside the Actor's Studio, in which the host of that show, James Lipton, mentions Close Encounters of the Third Kind and says, you know, in this movie you have the scientist who is merging science and arts, you know, with the lights and the music and the colors and all that, to kind of synthesize the experience of the transcendent. And, you know, is that you in conversation with your mother and father at the same time? And Spielberg's like, I'd never thought of it that way. But yes, that is exactly what I was doing. And that's kind of what this whole movie feels like, Alyssa, right? Is like him kind of trying to piece together that childhood experience in a way that not only helps him understand it, but also helps us understand him.
Yeah, well, and I mean, the movie is, you know, you have that opening scene where his parents are trying to explain to him what he's about to experience and how it's created. And for all the movie, you know, spends a certain amount of time talking in the text about sort of the emotional experience of filmmaking and the extent to which it's a calling for Sammy, it's also a very technical movie, right? I mean, we see him editing, right? Which is not the part of filmmaking that's dealing with people, but it's this sort of solitary technical, you know, one of the great first achievements is when he figures out how to, you know, put pinholes in the film to simulate explosions in a way that are more realistic.
There's that whole bit when he finds out that his girlfriend's dad has a 16 millimeter camera and he just starts spouting off facts about how that camera works. And like, you can just see his brain spinning about like, oh, sure, yes, I could shoot 6 minute reels rather than, right? And it's just this, because that's the part that like occupies his engineer brain.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, Peter, you were talking a little bit about, you know, this is a movie where Spielberg doesn't really tell you about himself, but about his parents. But it's also very much a movie about being seen and interpreted, right? And look, that's what children who are not, you know, artistic geniuses do to their parents. They observe them and they try to figure them out. They mythologize them. And one of the primal experiences of childhood is seeing that mythology, you know, wear thin or get stripped away, and then having to sort of rearrange the world around that. And part of what makes Sammy interesting is, you know, his sort of intensity of seeing. And so you have, I mean, I think a lot of the high school stuff doesn't work well at all. I mean, like, as a treatment of sort of mid-century California anti-Semitism, it's just really thin. But there's one scene in it that works tremendously well, which is the moment after he screens the, like, this, you know, Ditch Day movie, and Logan, you know, who has been, who he's sort of repurposed as the star of the movie, just comes to him and is clearly deeply unsettled by the way that Sammy has portrayed him. And the movie doesn't really get into why, right? Like, you know, we don't know if Logan is, like, uncomfortable with his Golden Boy image. We don't know if he's, like, actually gay. We don't know, you know, we don't know what's going on there. But he asks Sammy, you know, why did you make me see that way? Why did you use me to a certain extent? And Sammy says, you know, maybe I wanted you to be nice to me for 5 minutes. Maybe it made my movie better. I don't know. And it's obvious that it's the second question, that's the second answer, right? Like, it made his movie better. And, you know, if seeing in this movie is an act of revelation, that kind of, like, close, careful watching that lets him understand that his mother is having an affair with Benny, it is also, I mean, the movie is aware that there can be something kind of amoral in what Sammy is doing, right? That, you know, he can see people deeply, but he also has the power to kind of reshape them and represent them without their consent. And so there's an extent to which he is merciful to his mother, right? Like, he, you know, in a limited way, because to a certain extent, showing her that movie is cruel, right? It's like, it's a, it exposes her fully to herself. And the only kindness is sort of in that he doesn't show the version of it that reveals the affair to his family, right? I mean, he could have exposed her sort of publicly. And, you know, he does not hold back from that with Logan, right? And he uses the film kind of as a weapon to set up a rift between these two guys who have been bullying him. And the movie, again, like, doesn't get a sort of a deeper dynamic there in a way that might have been more interesting or enliven that section of the movie.
Can I suggest that there is something mildly interesting there, at least in the way? So in this, for folks who haven't seen it, which is a lot of you, because it's not doing great at the box office. But the way this section of the movie is set up, you know, there are two essentially bullies. There's the Golden God, and then there's his kind of like smaller but meaner sidekick. And the smaller but meaner sidekick is like the real vicious anti-Semite of that pairing. He is he's like really getting at Sammy Fableman for being Jewish, and is incredibly cruel. And the Golden God guy kind of goes along with it. I don't think he cares that much. It's mostly just, you know, kind of the background prejudice of the time, right?
And he likes having a sort of sycophant.
And he likes having a sycophant, and he doesn't want to rock the boat, really, more than anything else. And the way that Sammy Fableman puts that film together, it splits them apart. It splits the, like, real vicious anti-Semite, makes him the subject of fun, the butt of jokes, like the goat of the class, away from the Golden God figure. And I do think there's something interesting there about the power of art to split real bigots away from, like, people who just kind of tolerate bigotry. I think there's an interesting thing going on there, but like so much else in this movie, it's not really fully developed. It just kind of sits there.
It seemed to me like it was his first experience creating a movie star, right? Like, and that was the one of the main things we were supposed to get from it. I half wondered if it was at least a little bit about Harrison Ford specifically, just given that he's this super, you know, hunky, right, sort of, right, like, kind of all-American boy who, in that pivotal moment where he's saying, "Why did you do that to me?" What does he do at the end? He pulls out a joint. And he, like, we're supposed to see that actually he's a little bit of a weirdo, right? He's a little bit of, like, he's not quite the hyper-confident sort of, you know, superhero who you see, who we see, in fact, when he's first bullying Sammy, but also who the audience sees when he's on screen. And that is, if you know anything about Harrison Ford, is, like, on the one hand, kind of what you see on screen, and also, like, a little bit weirder and a little bit more of, like, this guy was, like, a kind of odd pot-smoking artsy guy who just happened to have become the most popular actor on the planet for about 20 years. And so I didn't know if it was, you know, that's speculation, but I think it was partly about the creation of movie stars, but it was also, I think you're right, Alyssa, to pair that with his seeing of his mother's not quite infidelity, but sort of where her heart is at. Because in one case, cinema is revealing a truth that he can't escape. And in another case, he's using cinema to create a truth that may not be fully real. And so it is to me, a sort of paired argument about what cinema can do. On the one hand, it shows you something that you may not want to see, but that you find it to be true and you can't help it. And on the other hand, it creates a reality. Because what he did when he created that movie star was he showed Logan, I believe the runner's name is, he showed Logan to his classmates in a new light, in a way that they already saw to some extent, but he highlighted it, exaggerated it, built that legend and that myth, and made that legend and that myth real to the rest of the class. And so it's, to me, those two moments are sort of paired beats about the ways that cinema both reveals and creates truth.
One question I had for both of you. Did you think his father thought that Sammy would end up sort of finding the evidence of the affair?
What do you mean?
Like, when he sort of, when he really pushes him to, like, make this movie of the camping trip.
No. I don't think so.
I think that was an example of his father's guilelessness, right? Of the way in which his father did not understand what was going on with his mom. We were supposed to understand that his dad just saw a distraught woman and who was having a hard time. His dad was not in touch with art or with emotions, but he kind of had this sense that his wife connected with the world through art and maybe through her son's art, and was just sort of like kind of he didn't fully understand his son's art or his wife's, but he knew that they were intimately connected in some way or another.
So did you interpret the early part of the movie as his father not understanding that his wife was having an affair with his best friend?
Yes.
I am not certain it even rose to the level of affair, at least in the direct sexual sense. There's that moment in which she says, whatever you imagined, it didn't go that far. And I also, yes, I very much did not interpret this as the father knowing that that was happening. There's a whole line about how he couldn't possibly imagine that anything is wrong with their relationship.
Well, there's also the line in the car when they're driving to California, right, where he says, I had a dream last night that I got in a fight with Benny. How funny. How funny is that? And I don't think that is him. I did not even read that as him, like, kind of, subtextually.
Oh, this is so interesting to me, because I thought part of what was fascinating about the movie was the clear current of understanding between that, these two characters that, there's something that is, that Bert is tolerating on some level Mitzi's relationship with Benny and periodically trying to pull it away and then recognizing that it's a necessary accommodation. And part of what is so devastating about the scene where they announce the separation is the extent to which, like, Bert is giving her permission and sort of excusing her. And that is, that almost more than the separation itself is what is so upsetting for the kids. I mean, you have that sort of back and forth where you have the scene talking about the fight. You have the scene where Mitzi is, in just like, in a way that is so inappropriate and emotional, insisting that Bert get Benny the transfer to Arizona. You have that scene when Benny buys Sammy the camera, where he's talking about like how they need to go to California, like this sort of separation is good for all of them. And I think part of what is sort of interesting and rich about the movie is actually its portrait of parental accommodation and bargaining and deal making and Bert's sort of tolerance of something unconventional and, destabilizing and his inability to sort of make that work. So I interpreted the entire movie as him understanding that sort of depth of feeling and trying to negotiate it. So it's interesting to me that you guys didn't see it that way, which is not to say either of us is right or wrong.
I think he clearly recognizes that there's an affinity there between the two of them, and that, you know, they are friends. I don't know that. I am not 100% sure that that is
the scene that's the extent that to me that convinced me that he didn't know, because I will say I wondered briefly whether he knows and whether the movie is going to tell us, oh, he's known the whole time. The scene that convinced me he didn't was where he's just like, well, Benny's my best friend. And he's just, it's this sort of totally clueless thing that he says to Mitski about, like, he's just saying, well, he's my best friend. He's just not up to it. He doesn't understand what they're actually arguing about the movement there. And that's because he doesn't fully understand what's going on between his wife and Betty.
And I think I interpreted that scene differently as, like, a sort of unspoken negotiation.
I will say the only time I thought that Bert might know was when he sees them getting into the car together and kind of like cocks his head like a dog who is confused by something he has seen. He's like, "Whoa?" That was the one moment where I was like, "Ah, maybe," but I still don't think.
I agree it's a plausible interpretation, but I didn't see it that way when I was watching it.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Fabelmans? Alyssa.
Thumbs up.
Peter.
Thumbs up. It actually hit me pretty hard in some ways for idiosyncratic personal reasons. It's a little long. And the California high school stuff doesn't totally work, but it's a very good movie.
Cautious thumbs up. All right, that's it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for your bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If it don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.